Hey, this is Talking with David Edge on 10th August 76, tape 3. So, you're not sure what they wanted to arrange
for? Yeah, I can't remember that at all. But I do remember that there had been a prior arrangement of some kind.
They were at the wrong place.
But the BBC were always turning up on the days they hadn't arranged. I mean, later on, when they did a television eye on research program, they were always coming at wrong times, and Martin got furious with them. But anyway, this lot had turned up. And Graham said, no, you come to the wrong place. Grange Road is in Cambridge and so on, directive. And they looked around and said, you're building a new telescope out here, you see, seeing this sort of curious jumble. And Graham said very rapidly, yes, we're building a new telescope. You know, it's not ready yet and so on. It's only in preliminary stages. And they went no closer and they didn't notice it was a shambles. And they went. And to my knowledge, it never got into the press. I mean, it would have been a fairly strong news story. It never got into the press that the thing had been blown down. And it took us, I guess, about 9 months to rebuild it. So it set the whole program back a bit. And that annoyed Martin, of course, because we would have had a lot more fully checked out stuff from that aerial before the 3C was published and so on.
It didn't put the pressure on the Paris Symposium thing.
Well, that's true, yes. We did manage to get results through, which checked out in some detail for the Paris Symposium.
I suppose it's not really clear as to whether that week guy was the cause and whether it would have gone down.
Oh no, I think it's pretty clear that was what was going on.
Oh really?
Oh yes. Martin designed the 2C3C thing and also the Lord's Bridge telescope with very great care about windage estimates. He got out the sort of rule of thumb engineers books in which they have, you know, figures for diameters of pipes and so on. And one of Martin's hobby is building boats and designing boats. Sailing boats, and he knows a lot about scaling factors and computer use of tank testing, this kind of thing. And he didn't believe the figures in the engineering manuals on windage. Mm. And he actually did his own recalculations and worked out again what should be done. And I think multiplied by a factor of three or something, the estimates for the amount of drag in various wind speeds, and then using statistics of wind speed, he could work out what he did. Now, Martin knew pretty well what kind of tensions there would be on those guys in those conditions, and I'm pretty certain that the situation was quite clear. He was unfortunate that over that weekend they got a stronger tension. I mean, I would have thought that any police officer investigator would stop the investigation at that point. Yeah. It looks too clear.
Now, can you just finish off the story as to an engineer was called in?
That's right, that's correct. That's right. Martin went to Mott again. I think Mott was. He wasn't still Bragg. I think Mott had arrived. Mott arrived in my last undergraduate year. Yes, it was Mott.
As Cavendish professor.
He was Cavendish professor. Yeah. And, of course, there was recrimination is too strong a word, but I mean, there was a post-mortem about it because it was Mullard money had been done and having insurance cover and so on, but it was still a serious matter. And Mott strongly suggested that Martin's tremendous antipathy towards engineers ought, in this case, to be suspended. And that although Martin had obviously done pretty well up to now designing these engineering structures, he really got to hand over for a consultancy fee to a professional. And so Professor Baker, Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Cambridge, was commissioned to do a sort of week's work for 100 guineas or something, and came up with a simple suggestion of cross ties from the top of each paraboloid tower to the base of the two on either side, so you can get cross-guying to hold the whole thing up and increase the rigidity. Well, it wasn't actually rigid, but I mean, stop this kind of thing occurring again. And Martin was very scornful of this. He said it's an obvious suggestion. In 5 minutes, he'd have produced it for nothing at all. And he strongly resented fee going to an external engineer. And of course, later instruments at Lord's Bridge, the 1 mile, which had got movable dishes and so on, and was government money, a considerable amount of government money. At this point, Martin had to hand over to the professionals, the Ministry of Works, consultants and engineers. And I, from that point onwards, I mean, I wasn't there when this was happening, although I visited it and so on. And one got a feeling from then onwards that Martin was beginning to feel he was out of touch with the actual building of the things. And it was the beginning of this
strange. So this was rather prophetic.
Yeah, I guess probably. It was the beginning of a sort of
really
strange.
Himself as an engineer, and yet he had
Martin is a touch physicist, an intuitive physicist. I mean, the thing about Martin is he knows with order of magnitude. He feels the universe with his fingertips, and it's important to him that the experimental apparatus and the whole of the technique is, you know, within his control. And when it begins to go away from him, so other people come in. He was always scornful of the Americans, you see. He had from very early days, this hatred of the Americans, in the sense that they were always putting up the money, and then they could commission electronic engineers. It wouldn't have to be a real astronomer. You know, a real radio astronomer for him was someone who not only did the astronomy, but actually soldered things and
when
built
you say the Americans, you mean the American radio astronomy community?
Yeah, that's right. Americans by and large.
Like the Harvard group, for instance, which was producing astronomy.
And the NRL, and Caltech was coming
up. But NRL now, I mean, they are engineers.
Well, now,
there are
look,
no astronomers in NRL.
Well, now, Martin's view was that in America, you'd say $1 million, well, okay, we need a design of a dish, we need a instrumentation, electronics with the following noise factors and parameters,
right.
And you'd farm it all out. And other people would make this, and then you would eventually come up with it all put together and do the astronomy. Now, to Martin, this is not being a radio astronomer. Being a radio astronomer means designing everything so you know intimately the limitations of it, and then doing to the utmost what you discover to be feasible alongside the astronomy as it develops.
Are you saying that there were, that in the 50s anyway, that nothing was farmed out? No amplifiers or IF strips or anything?
No. All the design and construction of every instrument was done in-house. Martin designed all the, Donald Mackay built them, but Martin directed very intimately all that operation. We designed and made all the amplifiers, the preamplifiers, all the equipment made in the workshops. We got special low-noise valves through from Mullard's. It's one of the reasons why Mullard's put up money for Lord's Bridge. We'd had this contact, and Graham Smith quite often went down to the Mullard labs in Surrey to meet the people who were developing low-noise valves, and we were getting, you know, that kind of prototype sort of stuff from them and putting it into preamplifiers and trying it out. So we had assistance. I mean, we didn't actually make our own valves.
I presume that you gave them information on the
Oh, sure. It was a two-way flow. It was part of their development program, too. But we were always getting new batches, and this was important. I mean, we were seriously limited by preamplifier noise.
Mm-hmm.
And because when Mazers came along, you know, we suddenly thought, oh my God, there's a way of getting low preamplifier noise we haven't heard about, but we can't afford the liquid helium, you know. And but we were doing it all. We weren't making the valves, but we were in close contact with people who were actually making the valves, and we were building everything.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was done in-house.
Right.
And this, I think, is an important feature of the whole of the Cambridge setup.
Right.
You see, Martin Ryle used to make sour grape noises about Throttle Bank and the way Husband was getting all his large fees for building the thing.
Yes.
But look, can I mention about the Americans?
Because
it was thought. Yeah, Martin used to say to me, what are you going to do when you finish? And I had applied for a college fellowship, hadn't got it. I was beaten. I was in the third place or something. A chap beat me as a nice New Zealand lawyer. That kind of thing goes on at Cambridge. How they compare law with radio astronomy, I don't know. But anyway, I mean, it was quite clear I wasn't going to stay on at Cambridge. Martin hadn't a role for me. I was not in on the building of Lord's Bridge or anything like that. So he wasn't going to sponsor me to stay around Cambridge, and I didn't want to go to Throttle Bank. I just didn't like Throttle Bank. And I was toying with the notion of going to Africa, and in fact was offered a fellowship at Achimota to work with that extraordinary man, Father John Costa, who wanted a research fellow. But at the last minute, Nkrumah got shirty with the university and withdrew the money. It was going to be the fellowship, so I didn't...
This was in Ghana.
This was in Ghana in late 58.
But is this
going to go? Yes, that's right. Father John Costa had his small show going.
Haven't you heard about this?
Father Costa, John Costa was an American radar engineer who, at the end of the war, became a missionary, a Roman missionary priest, and went out to Africa.
A Jesuit?
No, he's not a Jesuit. I don't know what order he would belong to, but he used to come to Cambridge and stay at the Benedictine house, I think, over the summer. And Martin was extremely embarrassed by having a man with a dog collar coming in discussing radio astronomy. I mean, he really used to think that there was something wrong. You know, I mean, people like that oughtn't, you know, we're different. And anyway, John Costa used to appear during the summer and have his summer vacation in Cambridge at this place, and used to appear and discuss radio astronomy. And he had modest instrumentation, but he was near the equator, you see. This was the point. And he was one of the very few sites where something was going on that would conceivably be able to check the overlap strip between Cambridge and Sydney.
Right,
this was the great attraction of Achimota.
How do you spell Costa?
Costa is K-O-S-T-E-R. Now, I'll tell you another extraordinary tale, which is entirely by the way about Father John Costa, but the professor at Achimota was a man called Wright, who was an ionospheric physicist, had come from Wales, I think, to be head of the department. And one of the things that he wanted to do was, obviously, to help John Costa get him some assistance. He only had one or two African research assistants in a very modest array. Did virtually nothing else but scintillation, as far as I remember. But he's, Achimota is one of the places mentioned when in 55 they eventually tie up the scintillation story and the burst story. Achimota and Gold Coast is mentioned as one of the places where information had come from. So John Costa wanted to build a bigger array and was looking for someone to go and help. And Wright had managed to persuade the authorities, the government, to put up money for a research fellowship. And it looked nice. I wanted to go to Africa anyway. I mean, it seemed to me that just
nice
education.
Leg.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, I a strong Methodist evangelical conscience, yeah. Moderated by various things, but still there. So it was all. It all seemed nice. But late summer 58, that was withdrawn. And it was withdrawn because Nkrumah got worried about, had one of his hate relationships with the university and actually withdrew the money. Now, so I was left at my beam end.
Did this fellow Koster ever actually do regular spelling?
Oh, yes.
What sort was it?
Well, he was based, as far as I remember, all he ever did that was of use, he published, I can't trace any real publication in the open press, but he did set up an array which was able to see a number of the more intense sources and therefore was able to do scintillation studies of them.
I see.
What more he did than that, I don't
know. Is he still there?
I've not heard of him for years.
Okay.
He's not mentioned in Ursi reports, though he's mentioned in our book, because I wrote him in.
Oh, okay.
He's not mentioned in Ursi reports.
Well, we digress.
Anyway,
back to America.
That's right. So my college, Chadwick, who'd been a prisoner of war in the First World War, and my father, managed to persuade the college authorities to put up £100 to keep me alive through Christmas, and I then went teaching. But through all this time, the question was, what was I going to do next? And Bolton came to Cambridge around this time. I think it must have been, yes, it must have been, the Paris Symposium, after the Paris Symposium. And I met him in John Shakespeare's room at St. John's, as John was then at St. John's, research fellow at St. John's. And we talked a bit about it. But I'd said by then that I'd begun to feel that I didn't want to stay in research. And I certainly didn't want to do just research. And what he wanted to count in would be basically just research. And I had thought of this Achimota thing, which was teaching. And when that fell through, I began to think, well, I'd do something else. And I was toying with the notion of doing some school teaching for a bit. And then, of course, the BBC thing came along, which was later. I went to the University Appointments Committee, and they'd just been lunched by the BBC, and that's how it was tied up.
So you became a producer of radio programs
radio
at the BBC.
Radio programs at the BBC. And that job came through after Easter and before summer. In 59.
Yeah, but just for the record, and that went until 66.
66, that's right.
At which
yes.
time you came here?
I came here on the 1st of March 1966.
And founded the Science Studies
yeah,
Unit.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, back to
yeah.
Martin said.
Yeah, that's right. Now, Martin used to sort of make very disparaging arguments about it. You don't want to go to America. You don't want to go to America. And several other people got this sort of thing from Ron Conway, as I remember, remarks that he had. Martin said, "We don't go to America. I mean, in America, you know, you'll just come in and look at the apparatus and say very nice and take away the recordings, and you won't actually be able to do anything very much. And it's a sordid business and corrupted by money and various other sort of remarks like this." Now, this all stems back partly to the war, of course, because Martin saw the way the radiation lab at MIT was built up with large resources, and felt very strongly that Malvern, which had started a lot of things, you know, was taken over elsewhere and so on. But the incident which keeps getting repeated, and which I do believe was actually genuine, was in, I think in 47, when Hagen, who had already at NRL begun to do radio astronomy, and was known, I mean, Martin knew him and met him. He might have met him in the war, I don't know, but anyway, he knew him. He was on a trip and was in London, and he got a US Admiralty car with a chauffeur to drive him London out to Cambridge, to Grange Road, to see Martin. And the story goes that they shook hands, and hi Martin, hi John, how are you? After the presentation, the very first question that Hagen asked Martin was, if you had $1 million, what would you build? And that's the very last question you ever asked Martin about, because he's not going to tell you.
Yeah.
And you've told him that you have resources, you see. And then that really triggered it. From then onwards, he had the impression that the Americans always had resources, and as soon as the inkling of an idea for a new approach would come out, they had so many resources and so many consultants and specialties all waiting, and all these little firms like Collins Radio Co. wanted to make their million, and Ewan, of course,
right.
who went to, Ewan McKnight to make his million because his father had made a million, and they were all going to do it. And therefore, you had to keep every single technical secret as close as you could. And this is built in with the secrecy, it's built in with that. And Martin had this view, and his view of American radio astronomy was not at all friendly. because of that. He felt that they were sort of hostile competitors.
Is it correct to say that you're implying that a large part of the Cambridge secrecy then was because of the fear of American dominance?
Well, it was the fear that other people who had the resources, and as soon as they got the know-how or the idea, would come through.
So it would primarily be American.
Well, it would primarily be American, but of course later on it was also Dutch, and so Canadians to a certain respect, and of course always the Australians had resources in some way. But basically the Americans were people who seemed to have the resources.
Or the Jargon, I guess one could say also.
Well, I don't think anybody, the sort of coexistence of Cambridge and George Robert, by that time we got the stage in which I don't think Martin ever really thought any idea. Well, no, that's not true, because there was this incident in which Robin Conway was not to be told about what was going on in Cambridge in case. And there were certainly overlaps. I mean, people would go to Jodrell Bank to give a seminar and discover that the Jodrell Bank people would be doing independently some months the same thing. And those Jodrell Bank people had to stay up all night and write their paper more hurriedly than they thought so they could join in. You know, that kind of thing was going on. So clearly information didn't flow very smoothly. But by and large, I don't think, I mean, Martin knew that ideas, for instance, for aperture synthesis, which was the basic thing, the supersynthesis notion, which he kept quiet for a very long time. 54, it was on notebooks, but it wasn't for a very long time that it became public and worked and was known as 1960. Later, the supersynthesis was known. I mean, I don't think Martin would be worried, because he's pretty certain that nobody at Jodrell Bank would be able to take it up. They committed themselves to big dishes, and that was where the money was, and nobody like Henry Palmer had the resources to do it. He knew perfectly well that the information could flow out to, and for that matter, the Malvern, without any trouble. Besides which, in Britain, you know, the politics were such that it wouldn't work. But if you let the information over the Atlantic, and of course things like the way the very long baseline independent local oscillator stuff worked out, as you read Lovell's book, this has merely confirmed Martin's impression through the 60s, that once again, if you let the secret out, somebody else with the resources will work much more quickly and beat you to it. And I think actually the VLBI's story with Jodrell Bank illustrates this perfectly. Jodrell Bank hadn't the resources to do both that and something else.
Yeah.
And so had to cut back, and the resources were found elsewhere. And whoever leaked it, not known. But I mean, Martin had firmly in his mind, and it wasn't that it was the cause. But once again, it confirmed the complex feeling about it. And that was linked, it was also linked to the intimate relation to the experimentation and the sort of business, the sort of mystique of
Was the strong arranged. Feeling against Mills carried over to all Australians, I mean, such as Bolton and so forth, by association almost?
Or? I can't remember any Australian being. I can't remember any Australian, apart from Mills in that instance I mentioned after the 58 symposium, actually visiting. I may be wrong about that, but I have no memory of it. And then Bolton appeared. Now, Bolton and John Shakeshaft obviously were able to talk to each other. I don't know. But I can't remember kind words being said. I mean, no warmth of feeling. And Joe Pawsey, even, who of course was well known before the war,
Cambridge,
during the war, came from Cambridge. Yes, have you seen his doctorate?
I know it's there, I haven't looked for it.
You ought to dig it out, because Stu Gilmore has dug it out, and I haven't. It says that it contains a lot of the important preliminaries for Fourier analysis, the Fourier transform method, and spaced aerial things are in that thesis. And Stu Gilmore says he's ploughed through all these theses just before the war, and Joe Pawsey is the one that rings with a sort of contemporary ring to it. The others are all pretty miserable. But he was struck by Joe Pawsey's one. I mean, Joe Pawsey never appeared. He never saw him. He may have signed the visitor's book and checked that out, but I can't remember meeting him. So there was, I mean, we just didn't want to talk about it. We didn't talk about it. By the way, the John Costa thing, I must tell you, was in 57, there was a big Jubilee Scout Jamboree in Britain.
Yes, and I visited that, actually, as an American Boy Scout myself.
Well, I was on the staff of that. It was an interesting thing. It had a storm in the middle of it. I didn't really pull my weight. I don't think I did my image any good, but I was on staff of that, and I was around. And after two or three days of this, and the sun was shining, and we were all struggling around, we know what jamborees are like. And it suddenly occurred to me as I was walking down the road that I hadn't actually done a scout thing, gone up to somebody in the road, shaking him by the left hand, saying, "Where do you come from?" and so on. And I ought to do this. And I was walking down this road, boulevard, and there were lots of people around. And I thought, well, look, I'll pick the first coloured scout I come across. I hope he's in Africa. I'll go up to him and I'll shake him by the hand.
Yeah.
And introduced myself. And there was a chap walking down the road and in a Rover Scout uniform and coloured. early 20s. I thought, just a job. So I went up and I said, hi, shook him by the left hand, said, I'm David Edge, I come from Cambridge, I'm a Cambridge University broker, who are you? And he gave me his name, I can't remember his name. So I looked at his shoulder, flash, where do you come from? He said, you come from Achimoto. Oh, I said, I know some of the Achimoto. He's Cambridge summer, John Costa. His name's John Costa, you don't have that. Oh, he said, I'm his research assistant.
Oh, amazing.
So there you are, he had a research assistant.
Can we go back to Ralph? Can you tell me that small little anecdote about the when Lovell had gotten his dish and Lyle was making a sketch of it?
Oh, this was one of the end stories that one.
Illustrate
Ryle's humor. Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Times in those days had just pictures on the back page in the wig block, and the artist sketches for the final artist sketches for the 205th. The 250 foot dish were available and been published, were being published. And the Times had devoted the whole of the block on the back page to this one sketch.
Right.
And the sketch showed the dish looking lovely on its rails and a little road leading up to it. And Martin Ryle was seen in his office on his desk, poring over this picture, scribbling little things along the road. And they said to him, Mr., what are you up to? Because he always called Mr. MR being his initial. Mr., what are you doing? Ah, he said, he's a sour grape treat. And this, you shouldn't put too much weight on a little anecdote like that, but the fact that anecdotes of that kind, which are a large number, well, I mean, they're genuine, and people actually saw Martin doing this, and it's genuine, and, and Martin would agree that it's genuine. But the fact that it happened is one thing. The fact that they were continually repeated and incorporated into the folklore is another. Like the way in which at Jodrell Bank you said, you talked about the way Lovell interacted with people at Jodrell Bank, they said, well, Lovell let you alone. Get on. Nice. I mean, he backed you and left you. And then you'd say, well, what's your impression of what went on in Cambridge? Oh, quite different. And two people independently, and other people off tape, would say, Martin Ryle checks out what kind of plug you put on the cable, you know. And now,
it's always interfering in some way.
That's right. Well, not so much interfering, but very closely controlling.
Right.
And the interesting thing is not whether or not that is the case, but the fact that at Jodrell Bank, that kind of story, which I had independently, the two people that the plug on the cable, becomes a sort of folklore, which builds up. Now, the actual reality of being in Cambridge was not that Martin Ryle kept looking over his shoulder and checked up the plug, but somehow the way in which he interacted with the other members of the group, and then you interacted with them, as it were, Martin Ryle's face and constructions were coming out of everybody. The group, as it were, mediated.
Well, you're saying
very closely
ruled by a sort of innate authority that people.
Oh, a very strongly respected.
You didn't need to do it through a heavy hand,
so and somehow the whole group then reproduced to you what Ryle would do, so that I was alongside John Shakeshaft, and what I was getting was Ryle interpreted by John Shakeshaft, so that when Martin came in occasionally to check out, there was no question of Martin saying anything extra and above or different, because, I mean, the group was the group was the group.
Yeah.
And Ryle's approach and ideas and attitude so suffused the group, you got it out of everybody else. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. So the control was very close, but it certainly wasn't the kind of control that some people think it was.
Yeah, now, you've given an anecdote that you say, relative to Cambridge, that you heard a Jodrell a couple times. Now, what were you hearing at Jodrell as to how Lovell ruled the roost?
What do you mean? What was I hearing at Cambridge?
Cambridge, yes.
Well, I mean, the view at Cambridge was that Lovell had exhausted all his scientific ideas by about 1950, had had none since then, and was exhausting himself, travelling up to London twice a week for committee meetings to get a knighthood, which was eventually got, and, of course, exhausting himself trying to get money to build a dish, and nearly getting himself in jail. And the poor man, you know, it was sad, but why was he backing the wrong horse?
Yeah.
Because the big dish to a Cambridge radio astronomer is the most naive way of doing radio astronomy. I mean, it's just silly. It's so limited in scope, and you really ought to be thinking more carefully. So, and as for...
Well, that was Lovell himself.
That was Lovell himself. Now, as for the way he interacted, I mean, I think the impression I got was that, well, there was Hanbury Brown, who was respected, there were people like Jenison, Henry Palmer coming along through the 50s, and Henry Palmer, a very quiet man, and it wasn't until the end of the 50s that he really made any great impact through the publications, because the work took a long time to build up. But I think most people, by the end of the 50s, greatly respected Palmer and thought that what he did was good. And of course, there's Rod Davis. We never did 21 centimetre at Cambridge at all, but Rod Davis was known and respected, and J.G. Davis was known and respected. And all these people were thought of as good, competent people, who with limited resources, in limited ways, were doing quite good research. But that these people were all pretty well independent. I mean, nobody ever, it was not thought that Lovell had ideas of any kind.
Lovell got no credit.
No credit at all. Yeah. And in fact, there were many instances in which it was clear that a certain amount of contempt of a various kind. I mean, partly, you see, one can put it this way, that Lovell, through the 50s, I think was coming himself to realize that if he went entirely to the scientific peer group for his status and recognition, he wasn't going to get very far. That he was having to hand over the radar work and he had to people at Drodle Bank. He wasn't developing anything on his own alongside it. If he just relied on the scientific peer group for his status and recognition, he wasn't going to get very far. And at this point, he started to play to the public more. And he had to get support, but he began to play the scientific politician and statesman. He began to, he of course gave the Reith lectures on the BBC, the popular cosmology and so on. He started becoming popular. He became known.
Right.
And this of course eventually paid off. I mean, he became known and the US government gave him a lot of stuff. He'd be going over Sputnik and what have you. So he was moving towards a broader peer group, a broader social system of recognition.
Which also created yet more of a conflict, because this was exactly counter to Ryle's personality.
It's not just personality is to fall back onto a kind of explanation which I don't find satisfying. But Martin Ryle was somebody who was socialized into and only into. I mean, he came from an academic family. Ryle's father and uncle are both professors. His two brothers, one is a very well-known and influential GP, secretary of the Communist GP Union Association. The other one is a medical student health officer at the University of Sussex, and does a lot of academic work as well. And you know, his uncle is Gilbert Ryle, the philosopher. So he was Christ Church and the public school, I forget which one before. But I mean, he came out of an academic tradition, and he has learned from a long time that you do science, and science is a world in its own, has its own values and its own rationality and its own logic. And to do anything, to try to get credit by reference to outside groups is bad. I mean, this is corrupting, this is just something not done. You've got to play the scientific game straight and you'll get eventually some reward out of it. And Martin clearly had internalized this to a very high degree. And that was why, I mean, he never allowed himself to stand for Council of the Royal Astronomical Society. That seemed to him to be really marginal to what he really wanted to do, which is the research, because the research was the important thing. You get results, get truth, and that was only going on. And he was very scornful of Lovell. And he was scornful of Lovell, I think, partly because it seemed to Martin that Lovell had not only taken the wrong strategy in radio astronomy and had almost given up doing research, but actually had given up an important part of the game by now going on this
to
the public. And I don't think you'd ever get Martin Ryle to articulate this, but as a sociologist, I would now say this is clearly what was going on.
Yeah.
And what you got here was a tension between two colleagues in ostensibly the same scientific area who were beginning to develop different conflicts of peer groups. I mean, Lovell still, of course, can retain the scientific peer group, became president of the Royal Astronomical Society, an important person. But he was tottering between these two peaks, whereas Martin was saying, you've got to stick on the one. And this created a lot of tension, and you got a lot of feedback down from the accompanying body at Cambridge, which reflected this kind of view.
Stephen Weir would like me to ask about Ryle's religious beliefs, if you know. He's interested in how that interacts with cosmology.
Well, I, in fact, once had a very long conversation with Martin on this very thing. It was about the time the horse had ploughed through the thing, and I overheard Graham Smith saying to Martin in an office, a very high voice, it went through the door, that Ed was incompetent, he'd never get his PhD finished, you know, we really ought to, it was a serious problem. And I felt absolutely gloomy. And I went to talk to Martin. And this conversation went on and on and on, the light faded and we sat in the dark. And it became, you know, we talked much more generally about personal philosophies and background. Now, Martin Ryle couldn't understand his uncle. I mean, he'd read Gilbert Ryle's books and so on, Gilbert Ryle on the concept of mind and this kind of thing. He simply couldn't understand what his uncle was on about. I mean, this was the sort of discourse that was totally closed to him. He couldn't understand it. On the other hand, he revealed a kind of, I suppose secular religious. I think Martin Ryle would respond to the kind of philosophy that one of our professors here in Edinburgh expands, religious agnosticism, that is to say, that there's a sense in which one respects nature and the universe and feels its power and presence and overwhelming awe towards it without, as it were, having to use the apparatus of traditional theism to describe it. And Martin Ryle is a humanist in that respect. He is, I suppose. I mean, I think he would call himself an agnostic. But basically, by temperament, he's atheistical. And he revealed a sort of generalized view. It accords with some ancient Greek and Roman things. I mean, he's sort of stoic. Well, he's not really a stoic. I mean, Martin isn't stoic because he kicks against bricks all the time. But I mean, he isn't resigned in the face of it. But I mean, he feels himself, as it were, within a process which is not his making, which remorselessly and grinds on. And our job is to observe it and occasionally to divert it, I suppose. And as for this making an effect on his cosmological position, well, John Harwood, who is with us, is just publishing stuff on the race IQ debate in terms of professional differences, but also external factors. And, I mean, there is clearly here political, social, religious, if you like, broad commitments which make a difference. I myself would like to do a study on the cosmology, because people like Dennis Sharma have committed themselves in print to saying the reason why it was so appealing generally. Now, I didn't myself pick up from Martin any sense in which he was predisposed to steady state or Big Bang or whatever from some kind of broad religious or philosophical disposition. He was predisposed to disagree with steady state because of his conflicts with Ryle, with Hoyle and Gold and Bondi, and with the fact that as soon as he got a tool in his hands which could measure something and actually test something, it tested out steady state, which was the only model available that made predictions, and it went against it.
Yeah.
And at that point, the scientific ethos takes over and you simply back your horse. And I would find it hard to argue that Martin had any general philosophical religious predisposition in this matter. Martin himself finds it very difficult to articulate the philosophy of life, and I think he's very suspicious of people who do. I mean, I respect that view. I think that's a very sensible view to have, actually.
Yeah.
If you want to join the game of articulating philosophy of life, you're in for a hell of a time. And he's wise not to try.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. One final thing which I have noted here is the Sputnik.
Oh, yeah.
Thing. Can you just tell me about that?
Oh, that was lovely. That was totally unexpected. I mean, to us it was totally unexpected.
Oh, and before you... It was a Saturday morning session. Can you just tell me about these Saturday morning sessions?
Well, I can do this. By the way, looking back at my records, are you interested to know, I discovered one record of the 3C survey which has a curious little very high frequency interference fringe dying away, which is exactly what you'd expect of a satellite going fast over the English Channel through the thing. And it's possible that I actually saw an early Sputnik burning up in the atmosphere, but I'm not going to say anything about that. I've not told anybody about that. I kept that quiet because it might have been a motorbike passing Grange Road.
But anyway,
we used to have this regular. It started in 54. It started before I arrived, the year before I arrived in the group. It was becoming clear the literature was so huge that no one person could keep up with it, and the group ought to, in some way, digest it. And so the governing body decided that we ought to have this regular Saturday morning. We used to come in, as I remember, at 9 o'clock. And the discussions used to go through at least to noon. And John Shakeshaft was in charge of searching all the literature, which he did very diligently, extracting possibly interesting titles and putting them on mimeograph sheets, which he did spaced inch or 2 inches apart, so he'd make notes. And these were distributed around, and the paper was cited very carefully, and each person in the group was given a paper or two.
Students and staff.
Oh, everybody, yeah, right. Graduate students. Visiting fellows as well. You'll find on these lists Hollinger.
And Ryle also?
Oh, yes, everybody.
Right.
And it was pretty evenly shared, too. I mean, it wasn't the case that Ryle being better got more.
Yeah.
Graduate students were perhaps given a few less in their early their early weeks as they got in. And also there was a question, people had special topics, so although it wasn't that clear, so you tend to get some sorts of papers done by some sort of people. But we got these sheets, and they were regularly put in our pigeonholes. And these sheets had if you had your name attached to the paper, that was an injunction. You should go and do the homework. Turn up on Saturday morning with your notes and wait in the queue. And then we discuss however many people got notes. And this was a very intense meeting. You were chopped down pretty sharply if you hadn't noticed that the paper wasn't worth reading. And ventured to give a little lecture on it, you would cut chopped down by Martin or Graham Smith, sometimes reading Tony Hewish.
And these papers were often not on radio topics, also.
Oh, wide-ranging astronomical ones, yes. I mean, the loss of solar stuff, obviously in those days there was still a good deal of solar work going on. So quite a lot of solar stuff, would be some ionospheric stuff.
There still is a lot of solar.
Well, there still is, but I mean, there was a sense in which late 50s, solar wasn't really seriously in the program. It was still going
which
on.
Which program?
The Cambridge Radio Astronomy.
Oh, the Cambridge
Radio Astronomy program, you see. But there was still a lot of, not radio solar work, I mean optical solar work. And optical theoretical work in relation to sunspots and so on would be in the pool for discussion. Although at that time, very little radio work was then currently going on. Pat O'Brien had left. He left 54.
Pat O'Brien,
I hardly.
Right.
I think he'd left by then. And Tandberg Hansen had been gone as a visiting fellow. So, by and large, and Martin Ryle was no longer interested in the sun when he had been. But they were still in. And there was a wide range of optical things. I remember in the papers there were those incredible statistical papers on the distribution and multi-clustering of galaxies. And what's his name did them? I can't remember that. And these things we had to plow through and report. And this was an important thing for the group, not because we learnt a lot from the papers, because I think by and large most people didn't learn very much. There were very few occasions which you went away from that session thinking, I must read that paper. It's going to be. You much more often went away saying, thank God, that's a dozen papers dealt with. And so the group, intellectually, there was very little in terms of bringing to people's attention material which they then use and, of course, cite. There was much more of a continual discussion going on in which all these papers were scrutinized in a particular way and built up and consolidated a particular view of Cambridge. It was a sort of reinforcing operation. And it also fixed in your mind pretty clearly where the people were, what kind of instruments they had, what sort of perception the Cambridge group had of their competence. I mean, Krauss and Co. were publishing then, and they got drubbed so mercilessly.
Yeah.
I mean, they were considered to be off the end
detection
of the earth.
Detection of comets and so forth.
And that stuff about modulation in the radiation, 60-cycle modulation in the radiation from Jupiter or something. We were discussing seriously what the hell this would be. And then Graham said, the mains frequency. And it was 30, 60, 120, And at this point, I mean, Martin said, well, obviously Krauss is a lunatic, forget about it. And I can remember very definitely getting that impression. He clearly didn't know the instrumentation, didn't know what he was doing. And that kind of thing went on Saturday morning. You got
and
that.
This was the only time the group was together.
This was the main. Well, it wasn't the only time, because we did have seminars and we all got together. Yeah. But the seminars were basically visitors and we discussed. This was the real place. And there were also some formal courses. We did a certain amount of teaching formally, but really it wasn't important. The important thing where you really got in touch with what the game was Saturday mornings. And you also discovered who the hierarchy were. And you form your own conclusions about how bright Martin Ryle was, and Peter Scheuer, and people like that who could do things intuitively in a way they couldn't get after weeks working away on their own. And this kind of thing, I mean, you rapidly form your own conclusion.
Right.
I mean, people decided on where they were going to get in the hierarchy at that point. I mean, I discovered I wasn't going to be a radio astronomer on my own Saturday mornings regularly. But you learnt, and you slogged away, and you were part of the group, and occasionally you made a contribution, and occasionally you weren't shouted down, and the whole thing was. Everybody was open, I mean, everybody went, and everybody was treated in Christian name terms, of course. I mean, that's an important part of it, too.
So that it was on the Saturday,
that's right, on
October
the Saturday,
5th, 57.
Well, was it October 5th? I can't remember the date, but I believe you.
On Friday, I think.
Nobody, at least at Cambridge, had any idea that the rust was really sparking, and I don't think anybody anywhere else did.
No, it was a complete shock.
Complete shock. Well, we turned up at 9 o'clock, and some of us had heard the morning news. I can't remember whether I had or not. But somebody like Graham Smith would come roaring in and say, had we heard? And the news was that the Russians had put up a satellite. Now, it happened that the only other places in Britain that could have observed the satellite were Jodrell Bank and Malvern. And Jodrell Bank, knock off on Friday night, nobody comes in Saturday morning, unless they happen to have an experiment running. I mean, there's no formalised get-together.
Well, but surely there must be some military facilities that could have tracked it.
Well, no, sorry. I will rephrase that remark. The only ones of which we knew in the public domain, because these are the GPO facilities, of course, weren't built, because they had to have satellites to build them. I suppose you could have said RRE Malvern was a Ministry of Defence affair. Knew them all. But the only people who, to our knowledge, could have done it were Jodrell Bank, and Jodrell Bank never had anybody coming regularly on Saturday morning. And Malvern, once again, knocked off Friday night, and they were Monday morning to Friday evening, civil servants. So we were the one group sitting there on the Saturday morning. Now, what happened was this. We heard the news. Oh, Martin said, well, that's interesting. Now, I suppose it's probably a private strong signal, a couple of dipoles. Well, we've got there's an old set that was 81.5 megahertz, or so, 2C set. What's the frequency it's on? I think we had the information of that, as I remember, or we had some idea of what it was on. Forget how we got hold of that. I mean, it wouldn't have been on the
news. Published it.
So it might have been, yeah, it might have been in the paper. Might have been in the paper. That's right, might have been in the paper. So Martin said, look, in a slight modification, we can get the set going and we can get a simple two dipole interferometer array. Anybody like to have a shot? And George Whitfield, who was one of the great sort of soldering iron people in the group, a really magnificent workshop man, said, oh, yes, he'd have a go. So, all right, said Martin, off you go and let's know what happens. So George Whitfield disappeared and we sat down to the discussion of papers, which went on as usual. And as I recall, it was towards 12 o'clock. It was around noon. We were still sitting there. And the phone rang. And Martin Rahr picked it up because the phone was running. This was in, by the way, it's not the office that Martin Rahr now sits in, which was Jar's office. Martin Rahr has graduated up the corridor. Oh, because he doesn't sit in there now.
Well, in the old cabinet.
In the old cabinet, right. In the big one. It was one that Martin actually, when he was running the radio astronomy group, Martin shared it. He shared it with Tony and Graham.
I see.
So it was like every other. It was a small office with three or four desks around, and Martin had the phone sitting in the corner. Mm-hmm. He picked it up and said, "Yes, Martin, yes, oh, it's John. Oh, interesting. Oh, well, never." Put the phone down and announced that George had strung up this thing, and it was going off scale. George was just saying, "Look, the record's come through. I've got the going across. It's going off scale." And the effect was dramatic. We all just dropped everything, ran out to our bicycles, shot off to Grange Road, and proceeded to sort of, you know, to debate things and get things going, and we were. By the end of Saturday, it was clear that we'd be getting transit times, and we had a simple idea of what the orbit might conceivably be, and the game was on. And then we set up a cathode ray thing and to get much more accurate Doppler curves as it went overhead. And Martin sat there in the dark with his little cathode ray. It was an old thing, it was an old ex-Air Force cathode ray thing that just happened to be knocking around, which we adapted. And Martin would fiddle the local oscillator in the thing until it locked with a round Lycidius figure in the cathode ray. And he shouted out, "Now!" And Graham Smith, who was measuring the frequency as he fiddled it, shouted out a reading of the frequency, and somebody else noted it down. Right. And when the thing had gone over, we plotted the curve, you see. And we were beginning to get realistic results early in the week. And we phoned up Sadler, who's D.H. Sadler, who's the man who does all the calculations from the Nautical Almanac. Mm-hmm. And he came up and went in a corner, as I remember, with John Baldwin, who was involved in the sort of, his job was to calculate orbits and see what could be made out of these Doppler curves. And they had a long session trying to work out what approximations to make and how you get going. And approximation was flat Earth. First approximation, you could get, you know, things seem to fit and you could get an orbit together and you could start getting parameters together. And then we started sending what we could get to the Russian. And of course, by this time, Robert Bank had begun observing too. And I can remember Sadler sort of being around and being amused by the general hecticness of the experimentation. Martin Rahr was in tremendous form. It was day and night and nobody got much sleep.
You said before that this was the first time you really saw him in action as an
experiment. Oh, absolutely. It was the first time I really saw him in charge.
Oh,
I mean, he was working off his fingertips. You could see why he was a good racing yachtsman. I mean, he was really in charge.
Yeah.
And was having to do an extremely tricky experimental thing under stress.
Right.
And was doing it with tremendous...
That may have been the first time he'd been in that sort of situation since the war.
Well, it could have been. Yeah. Could have been. But it was absolutely terrific to watch the back. And the press all appeared on Monday morning. The Times man, I remember coming and looking at these dipoles and saying, well, is that all it is? You know, writing a sort of tired little piece in the Times saying they put up a thing like a washing line. You know, ho, ho, ho. It's all really string and sealing wax. You shouldn't take it too seriously. Very sort of downward turned piece. We didn't like the Times man. He was awfully upstate. But of course, we started getting press coverage. It's all in the scrapbook, presumably.
Right.
And then it happened that on the Friday of that week, that's just a week after Sputnik went up, the Royal Astronomical Society had one of its monthly meetings. And so they cleared time for presentation of data, and there was something from us, and there was something from Jordan Bank, I think it was something from Malvern too. Mm-hmm. And there was Sadler was there, and we had some graphs and pictures and maps of the satellite thing going over, and we could make some predictions. So the next morning, you know, satellite would pass over Portsmouth or whatever it was. And it was all tremendously exciting, and we could get simple figures for the parameters of the orbit. And of course, the press all turned up to that, and we were all in a great state of high excitement. We were all piled into a minivan, all together in a minibus, and all went down for this meeting. And we're all dog tired, but Martin gave the paper and applauded wildly in the press and all that he did down. And the Times began its little piece the following morning. Cambridge professor said Earth is flat, because Martin had made this silly joke, and the Flat Earth Society got on to us. And this went on, of course, for a little bit of time after that, although not as long as a drop bank. I mean, we fairly rapidly handed over all this kind of observation.
I find that rather interesting, as I said to you before. You got accused of making the Earth flat.
That's right. But I also mentioned to you, when we came back from the meeting of the RAS, we called in at Baldock, to the post office.
The
place at Baldock, where they monitor all the transmissions, and basically to see who's infringing the agreements on.
Right.
And they had these marvelous Doppler curves of a very odd sort.
Which were due to the Sputnik, but they couldn't figure them out. This is the end of the tape. Interview with Ed.